love is sweeping the country.
Nat King Cole might not have had the singing career he did had it not been for the encouragement of the person with this voice.
So help me, may I never know the breath.
Maria Cole, Nat King Cole's widow, who has now died, was one of those who encouraged Nat, who was primarily known as a pianist, to sing more. And she knew whereof she spoke, for Maria Cole had her own singing career before she got married with Duke Ellington and Count Basie. Maria Cole toured with her husband in the 1950s and, as we've heard, released her own recordings. Maria Cole, the mother of singer Natalie Cole, was 89 and had cancer. I'm Paul Brown in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from USA Network, presenting Political Animals, starring Sigourney Weaver, Kieran Hines, and Ellen Burstyn. Premieres Sunday at 10, 9 Central.
Support for WILL is provided by Risk Management Commodities, presenting an Agricultural Outlook meeting at Trails Banquet Facility in Lafayette, Indiana, on Thursday, July 12th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tom Fritz from EFG in Chicago will be there. More information is available at 866-837-9027.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind, we will not be taking calls.
Every year in the United States, more than 80 million car trips are taken by drivers impaired by alcohol. Why is it that after decades of anti-drunk driving messages and millions of arrests, intoxicated people are still getting behind the wheel? This morning in this hour of Focus, we will review some of the history of the effort against drunk driving. And our guest for the program is Baron Lerner. He is a physician, an historian, and also professor of medicine and public health at Columbia University. And he is also the author of a recently published book that looks at this history. The title of his book is One for the Road, Drunk Driving Since 1900, and it's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. In this book, among other things, he argues that America has consistently rejected reasonable strategies to stop drunk driving, preferring instead to preserve the right of social drinkers to drive. And Professor Lerner, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you.
And you issue a kind of a challenge that I think is really interesting. At least it's interesting to think about. I don't know how many people might actually try this. Interesting to think about in the preface, where you suggest to people that they could do an experiment and they could be the subjects, that they could go out and get a breathalyzer, one of these things that you blow into and it tells you what your blood alcohol level is, and then have a partner so you could have somebody who will look after you, and start to drink. And get to the point where, essentially what you're saying is, you know, get to the point, however much it takes you, so that you are at the level of legal intoxication. And then ask yourself, how do you feel? And do you think you should be driving? And it sounds as if your argument is that the level that we have now pretty much across the United States, the 0.08%, is still too high, and that if people are driving with that, they're impaired, but they're not illegal.
Yeah, it's an interesting experiment to do, and I got my breathalyzer off Amazon.com, so they're easy to get, and I did the experiment myself. I did it because I was working on this topic, and at some point I said to myself, gee, I want to actually know what it's like to try to get behind the wheel after I've been drinking. And so I did that experiment that I challenge people to do in the book. And yes, the main finding, and look, everyone has different alcohol tolerance and people are going to get different levels, so that's an important caveat. But as I suspected, it took a very large amount of alcohol on an empty stomach for me to get up to the 0.08 level. So I was quite buzzed at a level lower than that. I took three drinks on an empty stomach, and I got to 0.05, which was legal if I'm able to maneuver the wheel fine and not get pulled over. But to get to 0.08, I had to have five drinks on an empty stomach. And by that point, my wife was my partner, and I was really pretty plastered And it just made me realize that in this country, even though things have gotten much stricter, we still have a relatively lenient policy as far as drunk driving, much more lenient than most other countries.
Yeah. Well, in if you look at other countries, say particularly comparable countries in industrialized nations, what's the legal blood alcohol limit for you to have and still be legal to drive?
Most other countries are somewhere between 0.02 and 0.05. Scandinavia has always been particularly strict, and it varies. 0.05 is an interesting number because that's about the point where most people get buzzed, and that's where most countries have wound up saying, look, why don't we equate being buzzed with not being legally able to drive? And yet this country has kept things a little bit higher. Now, this doesn't mean that if you're at 0.05 and you get pulled over, that you can't be arrested for DWI. But it does mean that we allow people who are at that level, if they can get away with it, to continually drive in an impaired state.
Yeah, and one of the things that you point out is that in this country, actually for a long time, if one is making the argument that 0.08 is it may be too high, that for a long time, for example, you say that people who had a blood alcohol of 0.12 were unlikely to be convicted DWI. In fact, you write here in the preface that people might have to be even like 0.15 and not only just be driving erratically, but cause a serious problem. Even you'd have to get up to that level, and we're talking now about, say, before 1960. But there was a time when it was even higher than it is now.
Oh, the tolerance was astounding, and when I look back, I think that was the most surprising thing I found was that yes, that basically the level for years and years was 0.15, which is so inebriated that it's amazing. But in this country, and people said this, I have quotes on it saying, you know what, there's some people who are extremely tolerant and can hold their alcohol really well. Let's not set the level low enough so those people can't drive. I mean, we bent over backwards to let heavy drinkers drink and drive. And meanwhile, people who weren't very heavy drinkers who would get up to those levels would be incredibly dangerous on the roads, yet, strictly speaking, it was not illegal to do what they were doing.
Yeah. It's really striking that if you look at this history as you have, and I gather this is really the first book to do this, you go back and you see that people were voicing concerns about drunk driving pretty much from the beginning of the automobile, from the first time that there were cars, people were talking about this and recognizing this was a significant issue. And yet, I think that you would make the argument that for a very long time, and maybe still now, that our tolerance, our level of tolerance for driving impaired by alcohol has been troublingly high.
Yeah, it's sort of a, you know, speaking out of two sides of our mouth. I mean, you're right. In fact, the concerns about drunk driving go back to the 19th century with train engineers who were drunk and caused crashes. And there's always been complete societal condemnation of this sort of behavior. How can you drink and get behind the wheel of a potentially dangerous vehicle? Yet at the same time, when it's come to passing strict laws, enforcing those laws, and stigmatizing people who do this, we're more ambivalent. And yeah, it's terrible, but there's also a bit of the romantic in it, a bit of a rite of passage for young men. So we have a very ambivalent attitude.
Yeah. Well, that's also, I think it's striking or interesting or instructive to look at the images of the drunk in popular culture over time and see what's happened to that. And that at the very least, it seems that our ability to find that amusing and light and innocent is certainly much less than it was, let us say, you know, before 1970.
Yes, it things change. You know, it's important to emphasize that. Yeah, you look at movies and books and things from the earlier era, from the mid-century, and you consistently see people drinking, getting really drunk, driving, and it's a joke. It's amusing. And once Mothers Against Drunk Driving and the other groups came in and pointed out just how many people were being killed every year by this, the pendulum did swing in the other direction, and some of the lightheartedness about this topic disappeared. But you still see in certain movies and on certain television shows this sort of behavior happening, and it's sort of with a wink and a nod, and sure, we shouldn't be doing it, but let's see if we can get away with it, that sort of thing.
But it seems to come down to what maybe the difficulty of dealing with this issue has something to do with our feeling, the society's feeling, generally speaking, that people have a right to drink if they make that choice. They certainly have a right to drive. That seems to me a fundamental right. And that we've, a lot of the time, we've taken this attitude that says, well, we're going to leave it up to the individual to make the judgment whether he or she is actually capable of doing both of those things at the same time.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think that's a good way to phrase it. Absolutely a right to drink, absolutely a right to drive. You know, to me, when you mix the two of them, your rights should be curtailed. But exactly what's happened is that people say, you know what, I have the right after work to go get a couple of drinks and then drive home. I have the right to go to a dinner party and have maybe three drinks and go home. And look, most of these people make it home. And part of the reason it's been hard to enforce drunk driving in this country is that most people who drink and drive actually make it home safely. And therefore, people think it's not such a big deal. But the problem is the folks who have one extra drink, lose their judgment, and then something terrible happens.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Baron Lerner. He is a professor of medicine and public health at Columbia University. He's also a physician and an historian, and is the author of the book One for the Road, that takes a look at drunk driving since 1900, and particularly at the effort to curtail drunk driving and how as a society we have responded to that. Johns Hopkins University Press is the publisher. We have a couple of callers here. We'll get them into the conversation. Others who are listening are welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. First up, we have someone in Peoria, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello?
Yeah, good morning. Good topic. It's a serious problem. But I got to tell you, we're not talking about the issues that really matters more than just the drinking part of it. I think it's okay. I think people are pretty smart. Most of us are pretty smart. Part of the problem I see, the hang-up, is in the judicial system, where there's people, and I read this in the paper all the time, those guys that get stopped, they have 2, 3, 4, 5, even sometimes 10 DUIs. They still manage to drive. And I don't get this. And, I mean, I think that's part of the problem. If you get stopped, even if you lower it, those people are going to keep being habitual drinking and driving people. And unless there's a way to hook up a device to a vehicle and make it not run, I mean, it all vehicles should have this somehow, some way, do something. Because I'm a retired paramedic, and I've seen way too much waste. And it's heartbreaking when you have to see the kind of stuff that I have seen because of stupidity in this country. And it's not just drinking and driving. It's the drugs. It's just the texting. And vehicles, to me, are worse than guns. It's a death trap. You know, it's like you take your life in your own hands when you drive it. So you're adding a situation and making it worse. And I think most people are smart, but, you know, again, you're not answering, you know, you got to focus on the big picture, which is how do you stop the habitual drunk driving guy? I'll get off and listen. Thanks.
And I think that really, caller makes a number of good points, but I'm particularly interested in the issue that he brings up of the problem of the habitual offender, but also to what extent the habitual offender is a big problem as compared to the occasional person who, you know, all it takes is one time and one bit of bad judgment and you could have a really bad outcome.
Well, yeah, a couple of very interesting issues. The data is pretty clear that habitual drinkers and binge drinkers are the biggest part of the problem. So 75% of people who are involved in drunk driving crashes are what we would call binge drinkers, people who drink heavily on an empty stomach in order to get drunk. So that's a problem, not to dismiss what we might call social drinkers, but those folks are the biggest problem. And legal authorities know this. That's the group that's getting a lot of focus, which raises the issue that the caller suggested of how do you deal with these folks if they're stopped multiple times, if they get arrests, and why are they allowed back on the roads? It is much better than it used to be. These people, it used to be completely a wink and a nod. I tell a bunch of stories in the book about people killed by drunk drivers who had multiple past DWIs and had never seen a day in jail. So it used to be completely like the Wild West. Now we do have devices along the lines that were suggested. Something called ignition interlocks are put into cars of people who are convicted of DWI, and they prevent the car from starting if the person has alcohol on their breath. What's so interesting is how variable it is from state to state, which speaks to the exact issue we're talking about, how we're ambivalent in this country. I think 12 states, if you're convicted of one DWI, you will get an ignition interlock put in your car. Another 20 or so states, you have to have multiple DWI convictions before you get them put in your car. And other states don't use them at all.
We have some other callers here. Let me just put in one of the emails that I've gotten here, because I've gotten an email from someone who says they're, in fact, a former dispatcher for an ambulance service, which means that they have some intimate knowledge of the effects of drunk driving. They write, "I have zero tolerance in my own life, which I've translated to my three teenage drivers. However, the person writes that they're concerned about lowering the legal limits. They're afraid that people will say, you know, it used to be 0.12, and then it was 0.1, and now it's 0.8, and you're talking about dropping it to 0.5, and people will say that that's not necessary. And again, maybe people will see this as tightening the leash on those most likely to drive drunk. But what it's not doing is maybe fostering in people the overall feeling of responsibility of them being able to know what their limit is and how much they can drink and still be able to operate a motor vehicle safely."
Yeah, that's a good point. And in fact, if you look at the MAD website now, lowering things to 0.05 is pretty low priority. They're pushing on things like ignition interlocks and roadside testing where people are randomly stopped, that sort of thing. And the fact is, you probably would save some lives by lowering the level to 0.05, but from a political perspective at this point, it's just not going to happen in this country. There's just too many political forces opposed to that thing. So we do keep it at 0.08, but we do try to supplement that with all these other types of interventions.
I have some other callers. I promise I'll get to these people in just a moment. But as I mentioned, you've authored this book that looks at the history of drunk driving and how things have changed over time. And one of the big changes that came along was the availability of some kind of easy device that could actually be used to get an objective measuring of what the person's blood alcohol level was. And of course, then you have to go from that to the point of deciding how much is too much. But how much did the fact that we have had things that would do that change the approach to drunk driving?
Well, it helped enormously. I mean, before the first device was actually called a drunkometer, It was invented in the 1930s, and the idea was you could blow in to a balloon and use chemical reaction to get a pretty close estimate of the blood alcohol level. Before that, all there was roadside sobriety testing, which we still do. Can you walk a straight line? Can you count back from 100? An old favorite of the police was trying to get people to say Methodist Episcopal three times fast, which I tried myself, and I can't even do when I'm sober. So that was what was done, but that was very subjective, and there was no data there. And what happened as a result was that people, even those who were drunk, who failed roadside testing, could get their convictions thrown out because it would be basically their word against the policeman's word, and especially if they had a smart, clever lawyer, it was very difficult to convict people purely on those sorts of subjective tests. So getting numbers, now that hasn't solved the problem by any means, but that's at least given some data for people to use when you get into the courtroom.
All right, let's talk with some of the callers. Next is Atlanta, Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I want to bring another caveat to this whole thing, is particularly in relationship to this country and other countries. I live pretty far out in the boonies, so if we want to go out to eat, it's at least a 30-mile drive, no matter where we want to go. And being older, one of the great pleasures in life for us is to go out to eat maybe once a week and have a couple glasses of wine, which is probably not going to put me over the 0.08 level. But like you said, there's, you know, possibilities of impairment there. And I hate that idea of being impaired and driving back home. But on the other hand, the pleasures of going out to eat and having a couple drinks is kind of supersedes the fear of driving home drunk, and I continually do it. And the thing in this country, because of the lack of any kind of transportation on for people other than the car, there really isn't any choice. In Europe, you have mass transportation that's, and you got population density. Their places are a lot closer. And I think in the history of the United States, you know, drinking and driving, if you want those pleasures, there's no other real choice of doing it. And not that I'm complaining, but I think that's one of the factors in why it's more tolerated here, because there's no other choice. And this part of driving kind of bumps up to old age drivers. I have an ex-father-in-law that at 99 took his driver's test and made some terrible mistakes, like one of them running a stop sign. But he still got his driver's license because he was living alone on his own and had to get to the grocery store and those kind of things. And I think at old age, because there's no other possibility of getting there but by car, that he was allowed to drive. And I'm sure looking at his car, he was as dangerous as any 0.08 driver would be. So the whole car thing is an issue above and beyond just the drinking. It's a necessity. And if you want to have some pleasures in life that you think are pleasures, the car is the only answer. And in your research, I just wondered how that all fit in, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, that's, again, another good point. In fact, Professor Lerner, one of the things you write about in the book is, say, in the 50s and 60s, when there was growth in suburbs and interstate highways, more people were driving, there was a big increase in drunk driving for just the reasons that the caller cites.
Yeah, I appreciate that call, because it really puts one of the challenges in good perspective. Yeah, what do you do in a country where, admittedly, the public transportation is not as good as in Europe, and that it definitely helps those folks? You know, what do you do when you want to have a pleasurable dinner? And, you know, there's some good answers to this. So one answer is, instead of maybe having two drinks with dinner, the person who's going to be driving back just has one, right? So it sounded like it was a husband and wife. How about the one of them being the, quote, designated driver for the evening and having just one glass of wine? If you have the glass of wine relatively early in the meal, by the time you get in the car and you've had dinner and dessert, your level's going to be quite low and you're probably perfectly safe. So, you know, I think realistically, as the caller suggested, we don't want to return to a prohibition state here where we say, you know, you can't go out to dinner and have a drink. But you can do it in a smart way that it makes your risk much, much lower. You know, the point about the elderly drivers is right on the money. And drunk driving, what they now call drugged driving, distracted driving, drowsy driving, they all seem to have these associated with them. They're all dangerous, and they all really need to be better regulated, and people have to take them all seriously.
Okay, let's go to Charleston for another caller, line number two. Hello.
Hi. My comments about a statement both Mr. Moderator, you made, and your guest, and that is that driving is a right. I'm a police officer in Illinois, and driving is not a right. It's a privilege. And I know it's just some a question of semantics, but I think it's a need for a fundamental change in the way we think about driving. Also, I think that the best way, as we've seen with speed, to reduce offenses is increase the penalty. And I'm not talking about incarceration. I'm talking about people will listen when it costs them more money. And if we make it so cost prohibitive to get a conviction for DUI with increased mandatory fines, I think it would do more to cure the problem than almost anything else we could do. I'll hang up and listen.
All right, thanks. And I think, I guess in my case, when I was talking about driving being a right, wasn't so much intending to be stating an opinion as stating my feeling about how people feel about it. That is, you know, how generally Americans feel. Although I think the officer's point is well taken. What do you think, Professor Lerner, about his argument that one way to get at this would be to make the penalties a lot more stiff than they are?
There's pretty good data now about that's supportive of that. When they first started to toughen drunk driving laws, the inclination was to put people in prison for long periods of time, and people thought that would absolutely be a deterrent. Turned out not to be an incredibly good deterrent. What is the best deterrent is to make people think they're going to get caught. So even better than large amounts of money is if you've got a very active anti-drunk driving campaign in your community and the police are out there and you get folks nervous about getting caught, the rates of drunk driving go way down. The problem is how do you keep that up and how do you pay for it? So that's tricky. But the caller is absolutely right that if people think that they're going to get caught and there's an immediate penalty, whether it's license revocation or a large fine or something along those lines, they are less likely to drive drunk. So I would be completely in favor of raising fines as well.
Mm. What, just generally speaking, I think that there are some people would say, well, really, the way to approach this is the way that we should approach a lot of things, but perhaps don't. And see if you can approach this as being a public health issue, and the way you deal with public health issues, they would argue, is with education. Is it possible that we could do a better job of educating people so that then they'll make the kind of choice that we would hope that they would make?
You know, it's funny. I think in an interesting way, we may have reached some of the limits as to what education can do. I was thinking that, you know, if you think about a term like friends, don't let friends drive drunk, mm-hmm. Pretty much everyone in the country has heard that. I think that pretty much all kids going through a health class, certainly my teenagers going through a health class in high school, get lectured at about drunk driving very vociferously. So I think everybody knows that it's a bad thing to do. One of the interesting arguments made by public health people, though, is that you could use other types of public health approaches that have been successful in other areas for drunk driving. So, for example, if you think about the successes in the anti-tobacco efforts, raising taxes on cigarettes lowered rates of smoking because it makes them so expensive. You could do the same thing for alcohol. We have put labels, warning labels on alcohol bottles about drunk driving, much like we have with cigarettes. And then what about the most provocative argument that raises the most hackles is how about better regulating advertising? And if we let beer companies promote NASCAR racing and put sexy women next to cars on advertisements, aren't we promoting drunk driving tacitly? And maybe we should regulate those ads, much like cigarette ads got regulated.
In this hour of focus, our guest is Baron Lerner. He is a physician. He's also an historian and professor of medicine and public health at Columbia University. He is the author of the book, One for the Road, Drunk Driving Since 1900, which looks at how it is over roughly the last 100 years that we have thought about drunk driving in this country and what we've tried to do about it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we'll continue to talk with people here and next talk with someone in Champaign on our line number 3. Hello.
Yes. I have a question.
Sure.
I was wondering if there's any statistics that show. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I wondered if there were any statistics that show if these drunk drivers and distracted drivers in general hurt more of the people they hit or their passengers than themselves.
That's actually an interesting question. I don't know about that data for distracted driving, but I will tell you for drunk driving, the people who are absolutely most likely to be hurt are the drivers themselves. So many drunk driving fatalities, most drunk driving fatalities are the drivers themselves in one car crashes and things like that. But obviously, the second most likely is the passengers in those cars. Lower down the list, of course, are what we might call innocent victims, although that's maybe a loaded term, people who are pedestrians or in other cars. But still, there's thousands and thousands of those people each year as well. But in an interesting irony, the person most likely to be killed in a drunk driving crash is the driver, him or herself.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Savoy next. This is line number 1. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to ask my question and listen offline.
Okay.
Earlier you spoke about a strong prohibition against drinking and driving in the Scandinavian countries. I knew an Austrian who would come to our house for dinner, maybe one glass of wine, but was absolutely adamant would have no more. And I'm wondering if you would speak more to how those nations are successful or not successful. And also, does it have something to do maybe with individualism in the United States versus a more community-oriented outlook? And I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, you pretty much answered the question the way I would have. You know, I didn't have the time or ability to study these other countries specifically, but Austria is a very good example. Almost throughout Europe, people who come from those countries and come to this country are stunned at the amount of drinking and driving that goes on. And conversely, Americans who go to Scandinavia or Europe or Australia, for example, for a vacation, find people there being extremely self-regulating, that they will turn down alcohol, that they will look completely askance at someone who's arrested for DWI. And I think it's a cultural issue. I think part of it is that in many of those countries, they're smaller, they're less heterogeneous, and there's more of a communitarian ethic that says, you know what, we condemn this as a society, we're not going to do this. And indeed, if you look back in as far back really as the 1950s and 60s, people were doing the modern equivalent of designated driving in Scandinavia. So as early as then, even though it wasn't called designated driving, the notion was someone attending a party or attending a restaurant was going to be the non-drinker for the evening. So I do think different countries are different, and part of the problem in this country is it's so big and there's so many people and they're so diverse that it's hard to get a single ethical principle adopted.
It seems that clearly part of the problem here, if we have not dealt with this, partly it has something to do with the idea that people have that their fellow citizens should be able to make that decision for themselves, and so they shouldn't be told what to do. They should make up their own mind, which maybe gets reinforced by a feeling that it's not a big problem, that is, drunk driving is really not such a big problem. Is there a way, though, in which you would have to say that people who are in the business of making and distributing alcoholic beverages have muddied the waters somewhat, and that if people think that it's not such a big problem, that the alcohol industry has something to do with it?
You know, the role of the alcohol industry is very subtle and interesting, and I really wasn't able to get access to, you know, documents from the alcohol industry on drunk driving. They're not really available. But I think it's pretty clear to say that in contrast to the tobacco industry, which denied the dangers of its product for years and years, some elements of the alcohol industry and the restaurant industry have been in the forefront of promoting things like responsible drinking. So for years and years, they've been saying, don't drink and drive, drink responsibly, that sort of thing. But at the same time, they've also been very aggressive in lobbying, for example, in Washington against stricter laws. So when people are trying to lower blood alcohol level in this country from 0.10 to 0.08, the alcohol industry was dead set against it, and they used all their lobbyists to try to thwart those efforts. Similarly, when there was the push to move the drinking age in this country from 18 to 21, the alcohol industry and the hospitality industry fought it because they thought they were going to lose sales. They're ultimately responsible to their shareholders. They want to make sure that we don't that they don't lose money as a result of this. So they have sort of towed a very middle-of-the-road line, which suggests that people can drink responsibly and drive. And, you know, as I said before, that's sort of true. It's just that when you're drinking, you tend not to be so responsible, or some people do, and they drink more than they should, and then they get behind the wheel. So it's a sort of a tenuous concept of responsible drinking and driving, but there it is, and that's, again, the effect of the alcohol industry, I think.
All right, we'll go on to another caller, and this would be somebody in Champaign, and it's live number 2. Hello.
Yes, you've just answered some of my questions. I was wondering about the industry. I think a lot of it has to do with the attitude around the drinking community. Just one example is the number of aluminum cans that go out to the landfill not harvested. Just little things that you were talking about community, and I think that a lot of the drive comes from the community level. If you're going to go to the industry, they were to try to have a bottle bill so that glass, for instance, could be salvaged. And that didn't win. It wins in some states, but only a few. I think the general attitude and how local communities handle it is rather important.
Yeah, I would say that's an interesting point. And in an interesting way, in certain communities, for example, Washington, D.C. has had a program for a long time that was funded by the alcohol industry that paid for cabs on Friday and Saturday nights, I believe, if people felt they were too drunk to drive home, and they would get driven home. But that was very much a local effort. There's a similar effort, I think, out in Denver. And when you have a country that's so diverse, I do think that it helps at a local level to try to do what you can. It just takes a lot of initiative, because many of the, as we've been talking about, many of the sort of social and cultural forces are opposed to these things. What's the big deal here? So I go have a couple of drinks. Why would I call for a designated driver? It almost seems like especially if you're a young man, who are the vast majority of the drunk drivers, it almost makes you seem, not like a stud if you have to do that. And that's unfortunate. Certainly when communities set up these programs, one would hope that they get used.
All right, and Ivesdale is next, line number 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hey, I think my point was a little bit hinted at earlier, but I think I don't discount the importance of alcohol affecting people, but I think one of the big underlying factors is the general skills of the driver in general. A lot of people don't take seriously the fact that they're operating a 2-ton projectile. And if you try and drive the speed limit, for example, you're tailgated, which is another thing, tailgating, And if you try and obey the traffic rules, you're pretty much in the wrong by most people, because you're supposed to drive faster and roll through the stop signs instead of making a stop. So people really don't take driving seriously, and they need to tighten up on the training of drivers in general. And I always joked about when MAD came out, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, they should come out with MAID, M-A-I-D, Mothers Against Idiot Drivers. There's a lot of people just don't take it seriously, and it is a privilege and not a right. And the basic training kids get is not taken serious enough. You know, what's the important thing? Well, how good of a radio do I have, and what do my hubcaps look like? Stuff like that, you know, it's not the actual operation of the vehicle. So that's all I had. Just a point that if people were better drivers in general, I think it'd make it for a safer overall picture.
Yeah. Well, we're coming here. I need to kind of jump in here because we're about into about our last 10 minutes here. And if any, you know, anything you want to respond to in the caller, you certainly can. But he brought up Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And one thing I did want to have you talk about was the significance in the whole conversation of that organization. And then there was one that preceded it, perhaps maybe not as well known, the role that organizations like that, citizen activists, played in getting more attention paid to the issue.
Yeah, I'm glad to talk about this because, you know, certainly one of the more inspiring aspects of the book was meeting these folks who got the issue of drunk driving on the map. Before, I talked to a lot of people who lost loved ones in the years before, beginning in the 1970s and back, and they pretty much all told me a similar story. They had gone to the police, they'd gone to local prosecutors, and were told more or less that drunk driving, even if it had caused a death, was unlikely to result in major penalties, and that they really, that the, you know, the police department felt bad, but these folks just didn't go to jail, and these people who were the victims needed to move on with their lives. They were really sorry. And, you know, oftentimes, as I said before, there were drunk drivers who'd been involved in previous DWIs who had actually then killed someone, and they still weren't going to jail. What was so impressive in my research were the first people, mostly women, but not all women, who said, this is unacceptable. We can't let this go on anymore. And many of them had lost loved ones or knew of people who had lost loved ones, and became grassroots activists. And the organization you alluded to, the first one was known as RID, Remove Intoxicated Drivers, that was founded by a journalist named Doris Aiken in Schenectady, New York. And then came MAD, which was led at the beginning by Candy Leitner, who's a name that some people might remember. And she was a typical victim. One of her daughters, she had twin daughters, was walking one day to a church carnival, got hit by a drunk driver who had been arrested for DWI only 2 days before. And he was let go, given his license back, and then he killed her daughter. And Candy Leitner, a very formidable woman, said, this is just not acceptable anymore. And she became the best-known drunk driving activist and started doing lobbying out in California, got much stronger laws passed, got a made-for-TV movie made about her, was on the Today Show, was on 60 Minutes, and did all those things that activists need to do to get their issue in front of the cameras. But she, like many activists, was initially derided. People said, you know what, why are you making such a big deal about this? What's the big deal here? But she turned out to be right, and I think that history has sort of vindicated the fact that there was rampant drunk driving, and it took a few heroic mothers to get this issue where it needed to be.
Yeah, although with one of the things you point out that I think is interesting is that she turned out to be, in some people's minds, a little bit of a controversial figure, because after all of that, her involvement with starting MAD and her being passionate about that issue, she went to work for the alcohol industry.
Yeah, you know, life is complicated. It made my book more interesting. Candy Leitner did briefly work in the 1990s for the alcohol industry, and she gave a pretty coherent argument for it. Now, many people thought it was unconscionable what she did. By this point, she was not running MAD anymore, and she got interested in helping the alcohol industry in some of the campaigns I mentioned before, so things like responsible drinking. And she felt that, in a sense, the activist groups had reached the level that they needed to in alerting the public to these issues. And she felt at the time she worked with the alcohol industry that they were actually being helpful in getting people to pay attention to things like responsible drinking. She didn't work for them for very long. And again, she got a lot of criticism for it. But it does show, it was, I think, an example in the book of the ways that this is a very complicated issue. When you make it black and white, there's always people who can sort of push back in the other direction.
We have about 5 minutes here. I want to make sure, well, I do have another caller here. I wanted to make sure we get them in Chicago, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
Well, a couple points, and points that I find never get made in this argument, you know, whenever I've heard it. You know, on any given night, let's say Friday or Saturday night, throughout this whole country, there might be 50 or 60 million people who go out and have a couple drinks and drive home with absolutely no problem whatsoever. And if I'd like to know if your guest has a percentage on any given weekend night in America, how many fatal, you know, drunk driving accidents as opposed to how many non-fatal, non-accidents, period. You know, and it's this thing where one person can screw everything up. Now, most of, as he said earlier, very often people who get into severe, you know, accidents are multiple repeat offenders. That's a different thing. But when you have a level of 0.08, you know, you have a lot of people that are 0.08, 0.09, 0.10 who are losing their jobs, losing their vehicles, losing their, you know, sometimes being imprisoned and totally affecting their lives. And they're not really drunk, at least not in my mind. And I so statistically, how many people die from malpractice or how many people die from any number of other things, percentage-wise? But this whole thing about drinking and driving gets so much airplay. I personally think that these laws are somewhat unfair, frankly.
Well, and there again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I think he certainly represents a significant a number of people, and that's an argument that people have made now for years and years and years.
Yeah, you know, that's a fair pushback, and again, it gets at the ways in which American society or other societies judges things to be dangerous public health risks. And drunk driving certainly has had its day in the sun, and things have gotten much, much tighter. You know, some people have argued to me, ironically, that now that people are so interested in texting and driving and distracted driving, that people aren't paying enough attention to drunk driving anymore. So the arguments go back and forth in various directions. You know, I would again say that, you know, if I was the sort of person who felt strongly that I had some kind of a right to have a couple drinks and drive, there's a nice little solution to that. For $40, go onto Amazon and buy yourself a breathalyzer. They work really well. And before you leave the bar, check your level. And if you're 0.08, sit your butt back down in the bar, get some fries, and don't have any more alcohol, and wait till you're 0.04 or lower to get back into your car. I do get a little irritated at, again, this people feeling that they have a right to drive at 0.08. You don't have a right to drive at 0.08. And you really don't even have a right to drive at 0.02, but you have more of a right to drive at 0.02. But I think people who really feel empowered that they have these sorts of rights, there is technology available to help them and to make sure that they aren't one of the small number but important number of people who make a terrible mistake.
Yeah, just sort of as a way of finishing up, it's interesting. I also had an email from someone who had been reading about what they had been doing lately in Scotland and pointed out something that they had read on the Scotsman, scotsman.com, about how their people are being warned if they drive drunk, they could lose their license, get a hefty fine. They could also go to jail, and they could have their car seized and crushed. And apparently what they do is they take the car, and if it's worth something, they'll sell it. And if not, they actually can crush it. In a recent television campaign, apparently it showed a man and a woman drinking in a bar while, in a close-up shot, the man's driving license was cut to pieces, and the warning was, get caught and you will lose your license, and now even first-time offenders could lose their car. I don't know how Americans would feel about having their cars crushed after having been arrested for a DUI.
Yeah, I don't think that'll ever happen in this country, but the sentiment is appreciated. You know, I don't think you can remind people enough, you know, just because they've driven impaired and gotten away with it hundreds of times, if one person makes one mistake on one night, it all can be terrible. And that's partly why I wrote the book, to just remind people that Most people involved in who perpetrate drunk driving crashes have gotten away with it time and time and time again. That doesn't mean that they have any more right to do it, because on any given night they could be the one making the mistake and killing someone.
Yeah, but
so
can
I
we?
Think it's just an important point.
And real quick though, can we at least say that we're making progress in the sense that today are there fewer crashes?
Absolutely.
Than there were, 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. So the numbers get debated back and forth, but I would say we've gone from roughly 25,000 a year to more like 12,000 a year, and so there's been about a 50% reduction, which is great. That's 12,000 lives saved a year. I wish it was even better, but that's an ongoing challenge.
Our guest for this hour, Baron Lerner. He's a physician, historian, and professor of medicine and public health at Columbia University. You'd like to read more on the subject, look for his book, One for the Road. The subtitle is Drunk Driving Since 1900. It is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Professor Lerner, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
Why do women tend to drop out of scientific careers more often than men? One explanation, female scientists feel disengaged at work, and that might have to do with communication.
The more women in their conversations with male colleagues were talking about research, the more disengaged they reported being in their work.
New research on the psychology behind sexism in science. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets as we head into the last few hours of trading on this Thursday. U.S. grain and soybean futures are higher, especially corn, continuing the higher overnight theme and to some degree reversing the key reversal, technically speaking, downward that we saw yesterday. Stressful weather conditions for developing U.S. crops continues to rekindle fears of deteriorating yields, with traders believing that just perhaps yield is falling quicker than demand. Forecasts for heat to reemerge in the Midwest next week is providing the spark to attract buyers. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. This is the composite trade, the combined electronic and pit in Kansas City. July wheat at 825.5, up 4.5. December at 863.75, up 13.5. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 831.75, up 24. December 856, up 17.75. July corn 773.25, up 22.5. September at 724.5, up 20.5.